Hier ist für die Zerherrschaft mit einer Aktionssendung heute zum Thema Demokratisierung und zwar Demokratisierungsprozesse in Osteuropa, am Beispiel von Polen, Ungarn und der Tschechoslowakei und eben Demokratisierung in der arabischen Welt, am Beispiel auch des Mittleren Ostens. Und hier im Studio sind zwei Experten, und zwar Angelika Büker aus Polen. Sie ist PhD, also Promotionsstudentin hier in Frankfurt und schreibt eine Arbeit über die Demokratisierungsprozesse und Transformationsprozesse der Massenmedien, also der Mass Media in Polen, Ungarn und eben der Tschechoslowakei. Und Uria Schawit ist hier und er ist in dem Sinne Historiker und Experte auch über den Demokratisierungsprozess eben in dem Mittleren Osten, Middle East. Ja, dann würde ich sagen, wenn ihr kurz Hallo sagen wollt, ihr habt ja auch schon einige Medienerfahrungen und in dem Sinne ist das jetzt das erste Mal, dass wir in dieser Art und Weise über diese Position im Radio sprechen. In der zweiten Stunde von Axiom werden wir ein Interview spielen und zwar mit Mariam Tutakel. Sie wird eben über die Medienpolitik sprechen in Post-Konflikt-Staaten und das am Beispiel eben des Wiederaufbaus in Afghanistan. Und das werden wir dann auch noch diskutieren. Uria, was läuft hier gerade in diesem Musik?
What we just heard?
Yeah.
That's Corinna Lodge, she's an Israeli singer.
All right.
Of Tunisian background. So that's pretty interesting.
Okay, thank you so much. Ja, Angelika, wie könntest du beschreiben, also wie du in deiner Arbeit die Transformationsprozesse von Medien in Eastern Europe verstehst? Also du kannst auch gerne auf Englisch antworten, wenn du magst, und deine Arbeit vielleicht kurz vorstellen.
Okay, well, I've been working on the mass media in Poland, Hungary and the Czech Republic.
Ja, du musst das Mikro benutzen.
Okay. Why these three countries? If someone is interested, these three countries were not selected at random. They are considered the most successful countries in the transition.
Yeah.
In the region in East Central Europe, and they have been developing in a such stable way that as early as 1990, they were considered as fulfilling the criteria for democratic countries. And additionally, the process of media transformation in these three countries, namely Poland, Hungary, and the Czech Republic, have a few common features, like reform media systems have been conditioned by the same similar factors, and also these three countries have accepted Western democracy and within it building up of free mass media. And therefore, they provide a good basis for comparative studies.
Ja, und du sagst zum Beispiel, dass Massenmedien sehr oft considered one of the most influential tools in the process of transformation from an authoritarian regime to democracy. Und wie kann man das eben beschreiben anhand dieser drei Staaten, welche Rolle genau die Medien oder auch die Massenmedien in diesem Prozess der Demokratisierung spielen? Wie gehst du vor?
It's very hard to answer this question because basically I've been working and I want to find out which role they really play in the transformation. Yeah. Yeah. Basically, the mass media are supposed to inform,
yeah,
educate, and entertain.
Yeah.
And now I try to answer what the mass media are doing in these three countries,
yeah,
or in Central Europe.
Beschreibst du in deiner Arbeit auch die Mediensituation eben in unter dem Kommunismus in dem Sinne in diesen drei Ländern, in dieser Case Study? Weil das wäre vielleicht interessant, um einen Vergleich zu haben. Also du hast ja wahrscheinlich selbst als Kind kaum noch die kommunistische Medienwelt erlebt, aber versuchst du sie zu beschreiben in deiner Arbeit?
To be honest, I don't really remember that. I was very, very, very little kid.
Yeah.
So it's very hard but to say something. But all I can say is that, for instance, Poland and Hungary, the media systems there, they were quite liberal. And mass media in Romania, for instance, they were completely or entirely subordinated to the political elites, to the Communist Party. They were not to do anything. They were as the political elites or politicians. They treated them as their mouthpieces.
Mm-hmm. Und indem wir jetzt eben eine Zivilgesellschaft und eine öffentliche Sphäre oder eine kritische Öffentlichkeit herangebildet wird, wie würdest du die Public Sphere in dem Sinne beschreiben, die sich jetzt seit den 90ern in diesen drei Ländern entwickelt hat?
Oh, well.
Spielt das eine Rolle in deiner Arbeit?
Yeah, but there is no civil society in these countries. Actually, there is, but not this kind of civil society we have, for instance, in Germany or in the UK.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very weak. So okay. People are not interested in any kind of participation in building up democracy or something.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, I think this is because of the mass media.
Yeah.
The mass media, they want to make money and they don't want to inform people to enable them, the people, to make rational choice.
Yeah. Das heißt, dann könnte man tatsächlich sagen, dass es aufgrund der Massenmedien nicht wirklich zu einer anderen Form der Öffentlichkeit kommt oder zu bestimmten Formen von Freiheit. Do you think there is a kind of deliberation of freedom in this public sphere in the media, or is it not possible because of the mass media structure?
Of course there is some freedom.
Yeah,
but
how
what
would
do you mean,
describe it?
But what do you mean by this freedom?
You ask a question about the revolution time. Was there a kind of revolution, or how would you ask this changing?
The Eastern Bloc. Well, I think the curious thing is that you have regimes which were stable for 40 or even more years, and then suddenly some of them in one day collapse. Now they say in Poland it took 10 years, in Eastern Germany it took 10 months, and in Czech Republic it took 10 days. That's a famous quote. But again, the question is, what is the point where this breaks apart? Why does it happen?
Hmm.
Why is it that one dictatorship falls apart one day and others don't? And it's an intriguing point, because let's look at the Soviet Union, at the high days of the Soviet Union. If you look at the Soviet Union of 1980, and you look at the Soviet Union of 1990, you might want to ask yourself, what changed? Now, militarily speaking, you could see a Soviet Union which was still as strong as it was. It had just as much nuclear power as it had in 1990. So that can be the reason. Now, let's look at economics. The economic situation in the Soviet Union in 1990 was pretty bad. But it was not much worse than it was in 1980. So it can be that. Then you might ask yourself, maybe it's because the masses stormed the streets. There were hundreds of thousands of people who wanted democracy. But if you look at the Soviet Union, and if you look at Poland, and if you look at the Czech Republic to its very last days as a communist country, you see that there were no masses on the streets. I mean, Solidarity was a mass movement, but how many people were actually members of Solidarity? 500,000 in a country of But how many people were active members? How many people confronted the police?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Not so many. And in Eastern Germany, perhaps, is even a more evident example. So we don't have masses, we don't have mass economic deterioration, and we don't have a military breakdown. So we need to ask, what does it take then for a dictatorship to turn into a democratic country? And my guess is, if I'm doing now, perhaps for a second, the comparative analysis between what happened in the communist bloc and what happened in the Arab world, or what didn't happen in the Arab world, that the main reason for a dictatorship to fall is for the dictators themselves to lose confidence. There comes a point in time where dictators are suddenly dictators, and the elites surrounding them are suddenly not so sure they can continue to rule by means of dictating. And that's the point where it breaks. And there you have an important role for mass media, because it is the one actually doing the mediating between those very passive masses and the transforming elite. But I'm not sure we know today enough about what happened in Poland and what happened in Russia. I'm not sure we know enough about behind the scenes of those processes. And if your research can do anything to elaborate on that, then that's really helpful, I would say.
This is basically what I have been working on. But the thing is, you said that the mass media have to mediate, but now I can say that the mass media, they don't mediate between this masses and between
the government.
Exactly.
Even today. Well, that's sad, because one thing I don't think we always appreciate about democracy, there is much talk about, again, the financial and the structural and so on aspects of democracy and democratization. One thing we don't appreciate enough, I think, is that democracy is basically an idea. In order to have democracy somewhere, people must know what democracy means, and they must support the idea. If those conditions are not met, then it's impossible to have democracy. It's true, if you have people who are educated, that's good for democracy. It's better than having uneducated masses. If you have a good or a decent economic condition, that's good for democracy, because when people are starving, it's very hard for them to be political. But that's not enough, because democracy is abstract. It doesn't exist anywhere but in our minds, willing to operate it. Because of that, you have to have some people who actually believe in democracy. And what I usually tell is that you wouldn't have a revolution in Eastern Europe without Lech Walesa, without Václav Havel, without Mikhail Gorbachev. You must have those people. You wouldn't have a revolution in South Africa, a democratic revolution, without Nelson Mandela. We shouldn't take it for granted that the revolution happened democratically. It could have been a non-democratic revolution. Yeltsin could have been a fascist. He wasn't. So when we struggle for democracy, first of all, we struggle for an idea. We struggle in the realm, in the sphere of ideas, which is a media sphere, basically, and an academic sphere.
Yeah.
But what if the mass media are not able to fulfill its their mission?
That's a problem. If you don't have a democratic... If you don't have mass media, which is A, democratic, that means democratically operating, and B, which is supportive of the democratic idea, there is no way to sustain democracy. You must have strong journalistic apparatus, which is independent and democratically affiliated. I mean, what do you do if all your mass media, all your academia, all your teachers, all your intellectuals support fascism? How can you sustain democracy? How can you teach the next generation to be democratic? That's a problem. It's a war of ideas.
Yeah. So, what kind of idea came up in Poland, for example, after the Perestroika, probably?
Perestroika.
Yeah, but there was no Perestroika in Poland.
Yeah.
Yeah. No.
I know what you mean.
It was a liberation process through.
Yeah. After the ouster of communism, the mass media, they were challenged politically and economically. First, they transitioned from unity to diversity, and economically free market. Before there was no free market under communism.
Mm-hmm.
So the mass media basically had to challenge this.
These ideas. Had to proceed, maybe, the ideas.
Were the people actually starting to publish newspapers, independent newspapers? Were they like businessmen, or how did it surface after the fall of communism?
Actually, in Poland, there was a very strong underground press. And I think those people who were doing this kind of journalism, they started doing this journalism.
And those were Democrats, basically. Some of them.
Some of them, at least, yeah.
And who controls the media today? The mass newspapers?
You know, this is a very good question. Very good and very tricky question. On one hand, we have some politicians, and on the other hand, we have some business interests.
Mm-hmm.
So the mass media are structurally, the mass media are free and independent.
Some of it. Yeah,
yeah, at least.
That's good. So you have sort of a competition between public-owned and private-owned media.
Yeah, dual. Yeah, dual.
No, you see, Felicia, that's a very important point, because you need to have free press doesn't mean anything. That's a slogan. To have free press, it has to be pluralistic press. It has to be controlled by different people who have different interests and come from different backgrounds. And for example, if you look at Russia today, I'm not quite sure this is what's taking place in Russia. I think the president of Russia is taking more and more control of the media. And anybody who has a cable channel and disputes it, well, he either finds himself in jail or fleeing away for his life, for his safety, or being murdered.
Mm.
No, that's not democracy.
Like,
but on the other hand, when you have democracies, and that is, I'm afraid, in many ways what's happening now in Israel, when you have democracy where the media is more and more controlled by a very small number of businessmen who have business interests, and through the media they also control politicians, that's also very dangerous. You need to have some sort of balance between the private sector and the public sector, and you need to have some sort of balance within those sectors. It's impossible if you have just one businessman controlling all the private sector. That's bad for democracy. And good democracies, for example, they have, you know, free radios, public radios, that allows every citizen in a very structured way to express his opinion if he's qualified.
Mm.
That's one sign for democracy. That's good on you.
So, this is just ideal.
Not necessarily. I think that's the case in Germany. I think maybe not on the tabloid market, but which is sort of one newspaper controlled. Mm-hmm. But if you look at the newsstand in Germany, you're very impressed. It's a very pluralistic market with many different opinions and schools of thought, which is good. Of course, Germany is a big country, so it's a rich country, and it's much easier to do that in a rich and big country. But this is an idea each and every democratic society needs to sort of at least inspire to, and be aware of the dangers of what's going to happen if you're not fulfilling this idea.
After were there some criteria for Poland, Hungary, and the Czech Republic to for joining the EU, that they have to fulfill some criteria to have a free press and things like that.
Yeah, of course.
Did they fulfill these?
Yeah.
Did that change something the last 2 or 3 years, maybe?
Maybe not last 2 or 3 years, but before 2004.
They fulfill some standards.
Yeah, they were obliged to enlarge the EU. They were obliged to fulfill some
standards. Yeah.
Some standards, yeah. At least.
Okay, and how would you... would you say that was very helpful that they joined the EU to become more democratic, maybe, through the media?
Well, Poland, for instance, this is a democratic country, but I don't quite see your point.
It was a question. If there was it's only the question how can we get an idea because we are here in Germany. I mean, how can we get an idea of the media's situation of media and the press in Poland, for example? It's only a question if we could get a picture maybe of how is there this idea of democracy? How do they understand this idea of democracy, which is very important for the discussion of peace strategies all over the world, maybe, and after the communistic time? Yeah, that was only one question, but maybe, what you said was that something like this democratic idea didn't happen in the Arab world. So how do you describe this situation in now in the Arab world, how they struggle with democracy? Because they had, and this is what you are describing in your text on democratization in the Arab world, you are describing that in the 19th century there were some struggles in the Arab world for
as opposed democratization. To sort of and the long-held view in the West, that there was never democracy in the Arab world, there was democracy. It failed. And one of the interesting things is that its failure is still haunting any process of democratization in the Arab world. Let me put it this way. We said before, relating to Eastern Europe, that in order for a country to become a democracy, you have to have an elite which wants democracy, struggle for democracy. We have to have the Lech Walesas and the Václav Havels and the Gorbachevs on one hand. And on the other hand, you need to have a regime which is ideologically getting weaker, doesn't believe in itself. Now, if we look at the Arab world, you don't have both. What we cannot identify in the Arab world today or 10 years ago when those revolutions occurred, there isn't a strong intellectual elite which seeks liberal democracy. You can't find this one. And the regimes have not lost their confidence in their ability to survive as dictatorships. Now you would probably ask me the question, why? Why don't we have such an elite in the Arab world, which wants democracy, intellectuals, and why don't we have regimes who actually get insecure?
Probably first we should explain what is the difference between a communistic regime and an Islamic regime, probably, or what you call Arab regime.
Well, that's a tricky question, because most Arab regimes are not Islamic regimes.
Yeah.
They are regimes of Muslim societies. They are not Islamic.
Okay.
If you ask a Muslim scholar, he would tell you there are no Muslim regimes today. We have Arab dictatorships. These are not Muslim regimes.
Yeah.
So maybe we can rephrase it. We can ask what is the difference between communist regimes and between Arab regimes in Muslim societies. And then we would say exactly that, that basically these are two kinds of dictatorships. These are regimes where the people who rule have never been elected. And the reason they are still in power is because they have a very strong inner security apparatus which support them. Mm-hmm. But that wouldn't be enough. As I said before, in order for a non-democratic regime to fall, like happened in Latin America and in Central Eastern Europe, you must have a democratic elite. You must have at least some people who want democracy. I guess we can agree on that. If they want a Lech Wałęsa in Poland, I'm not sure Poland would be a democracy today. I'm saying Lech Wałęsa as the symbol.
Yeah, and
but if there wasn't Vaclav like Havel, a strong...
Václav Havel.
And Václav Havel in Czech Republic, yeah, and we could go on. I'm not sure we have the Eastern German example, but...
not really.
Yeah. But you need to have, because democracy is first and foremost an idea, you must have some people who believe in this idea and want democracy. Now, I think we can narrow the question to one. Why don't we have those people in the Arab world?
Yeah, why?
Why don't we have this elite? And the reason is as follows, that it's not because we never had democracy in the Arab world, but just the opposite, because we had democracy. And in the Arab memory, those years of experience in democracy, that's in the 20s and the 30s of the 20th century, that was a bad experience. That was an experience which sort of taught the Arabs that when the West tells them to have democracy, what it really wants is to gain better control over the Middle East. That is the Arab experience. The democracy and imperialism go hand in hand. Now, it's 1990, 1991. There's a democratic revolution all over the world. Eastern Europe, Latin America, Southeast Asia. This doesn't take place in the Arab world. And what do Arab intellectuals say at the time? What do they say? They say, we should be very careful when we import, they use the word import, this Western democracy. Because this is not just a system of government, this is a way for the West to reconquer us, to reoccupy us. And this is not just a system of government, this is a system of values, of Christian values. So if we import democracy, we import Christianity. And when you search, you find very few Arab intellectuals who say, let's have liberal democracy, it's 1991. Here's the problem. What happened in Iraq hasn't done much to actually transform this view. Because what do Arab intellectuals say today? They say, we warned you. We said America is going to occupy the Middle East in the name of democracy. Look what's happening. America has already been for 4 years in Iraq, 5 years in Afghanistan.
And
what is the excuse for that? Bring on democracy. Didn't we warn you 15 years ago? We just said this is going to happen. The West is going to reoccupy, reconquer the Middle East in the name of democracy. Democracy and imperialism are just the same. As long as you don't solve this sort of Gordian knot, this sort of maze, you can never have democracy in the Middle East. Unless you're able to convince the Arabs that democracy and imperialism are not the same, you will not be able to have democracy. And that's the difference between Iraq and Poland.
Yeah, that's true. But the first thing is that democracy cannot be forced. And it is, as for instance, George W. Bush. He wants to force democracy.
Well, democracy was forced in Japan. Democracy was forced in Germany.
But, you know, Germany and maybe not Japan, but Germany, this country had some experience with democracy.
Well, Iraq had a very long experience with democracy.
But was democracy forced in the post-communist country?
No.
Countries?
This is a
democracy. I think there's a difference.
Well,
it's a big difference.
That's a big difference, but I'm giving the example of Japan and Germany. Western Germany after the war, I mean, people, I guess,
Stunde null.
People were, I mean, this was a country whose experience with democracy, needless to say, was not so good. It lost the war. It was devastated. And it was occupied by the United States.
And the United Kingdom, France.
And the United Kingdom, France. But basically, it was a United States occupation. And the Americans in Japan and in Germany, who wrote the Japanese Constitution, do you know? It was written by Americans. So you can't really say, historically speaking, that the reason the Iraq experience is now failing is because it's forced upon the Iraqis. You have to look somewhere else for an explanation. You cannot force people to be free, but you can sort of occupy a country, educate it to be democratic, and then go out. This happened in Japan. It happened in Western Germany. And I think Germany today is sort of a very example. It's the wonderful example of flourishing democracy, I would say.
Yeah, but this was a process, a long process. You know, democracy cannot happen overnight.
Well, Germany was occupied in 1945. I think by 1951 already it was a functioning democracy. Still occupied to an extent, but a functioning democracy. It is, I think, all those comparison and comparative analysis is good up to a point. But we need to look to the depth of the matter. And then we can say for sure, I think, if most Polish citizens and most Polish elites would decide that democracy is a bad idea, you're not going to have democracy in Poland. I think we can agree on that. And we must agree on that also
yes,
in Iraq.
Yes, we can agree.
We need to have Iraqis who actually want democracy, to have democracy, who accept the rules of democracy.
But let's have a look at Russia. There is no democracy.
Well, I guess Russia is, we can say it's a deteriorating democracy. We can't say it's a dictatorship today.
No, for me it's an authoritarian.
Yeah, it's almost getting there, yeah, I'm afraid. And you need to have Russians who believe in democracy to change it.
But we do have some Russians, and they want to build some democracy. But just look what is happening in Russia.
Good, but I see people like Kasparov. I mean, they are challenging the president, and that's a good thing. I don't know if that's enough, but that's a good thing. You don't have anybody challenging. You know, there was a guy challenging the president in Egypt. His name is Ayman Anour. Maybe you heard of him.
No.
And he was a big challenge to the president. Didn't have many followers, but it was a democratic challenge, not an Islamic challenge. And he ran for president. For the first time, you had in Egypt pluralistic elections to president. There were 10 candidates. Only two serious, Hosni Mubarak and Ayman Anour. And Ayman Anour was the only democratic one, wanting democracy, real democracy, liberal democracy. Do you know what happened? Can you guess? I'm not sure our listeners can see what you've just done. But basically, no, his throat wasn't departed from his body. But he was, 2 days after the election, he was convicted of fraud, of election fraud. And he's now in jail for 5 years. So that's not really a way to promote democracy.
Promote democracy.
No, that's not a good thing. If Kasparov is arrested in Russia, then we have a problem.
Yeah.
Then we have a problem. That's a good test for the Putin regime. Is he going to let Kasparov do whatever he's doing or not?
Yeah, that's right. So if you, as a researcher, look on democracy, and democracy has always to be experienced, to be internalized from the citizens as something which they can value as good and as important and as part of their idea of freedom and so on. So how do you evaluate on democratic democratization in the Arab world, and how do you evaluate democratization in general?
You're asking about the method of evaluation, or yeah. How do I evaluate the situation right now?
Yeah, no, how do you evaluate the democratization process in your work? I mean, as a researcher, if
you look at I look for is signs for those, for this game between those two elites. What I look for is, first, I look for signs that there is an emerging democratic elite, that there are some people who want democracy. I look for them. Can we find them? Can I find people like Ayman Hanur, people who want democracy and fight for democracy, willing to sacrifice for democracy? I'm looking for the Arbol's Lech Walesa, basically. That's one. And the second thing I look for is for regimes who start to lose confidence. Can I deduct signs of regimes starting to be unconfident? If I found these two, then I say, good on them. They're starting to have the first phase of what's needed to go through democratization. I have to tell you, the problem is, this is very hard to detect when it actually happens. We are much more clever in retrospect. It's much more easy to make prophecies about the past. So it is very difficult to identify the process when it happens. There wasn't one single intelligence apparatus, one single important journalist, one single important historian who actually foresaw the collapse of the Soviet Union. There just wasn't. You had so many people writing essays, why Soviet Union is going to survive. We need more money to fight the Soviets. That's 1988. And Poland, who is this Lech Walesa guy, people said, is not important. Who is this Václav Havel? He's like a philosopher. What's he going to do? And one day it collapsed. So I think we should be very cautious when making assessments. I'm not predicting the future. I think it's much easier sort of... that's funny to say, that it is much easier to research this process in retrospect. But we can't say that without those two elites changing, transforming, you cannot have democratization. Let me just one final sentence. If you want to sort of visualize this, think of a tunnel. Think of a tunnel underneath the ground. And I equate it to democratization to a tunnel. You need to have two things for democratization to happen. That on one end of the tunnel, you'll have those democratic fighters who start to slowly sort of warning the regime's credibility and self-confidence. You know, they can draw graffiti on the wall. They can do a strike, like Solidarity did at Gdansk. So it's slowly. On the other end of the tunnel, picture the other end of the tunnel, you have the regime, which is slowly losing the confidence. You can't really see that because it's a very secluded regime. It's a dictatorship. And the tunnel is slowly falling apart. You can't see that because it's slowly and it's underneath the ground. And then one day it collapses all of a sudden. You're not inside the tunnel. You cannot tell when it's going to collide, when it's going to collapse. But one day it collapses, like all tunnels do.
But it needs time.
It takes time. It takes lots of time. And it's very slowly. Somebody draws a graffiti on the wall in Warsaw. And to communism. That's another one small bite in the tunnel. And then the wife of one of the ministers, at night, she tells her husband, maybe communism is not a good idea. That's another small bite in the tunnel. When you have hundreds of those small bites, the tunnel collapses.
But maybe the thing is that you guys from the Middle East, maybe you need this, I guess this was described by Huntington, this snowballing effect.
Demonstration effect, snowballing.
Yeah, snowballing effect that... changes in one country can provoke changes in another country. Maybe you need this.
That's a great point, and I think that's a wonderful point. And what George Bush actually said when he invaded Iraq, he said it in several of his speeches, which, of course, he didn't write himself, but at least he read it aloud, so let's say that's his speeches, and he said very, very, very very specifically said, we hope that Iraq is going to be the first milestone in democratization in the Middle East. People in Egypt and Syria will see what happened in Iraq, and they would want democracy too. Just like people in Czech Republic saw what happened in Hungary and Poland, and they wanted democracy. That's what Huntington referred to as the demonstration effect or the snowball effect. Unfortunately, I think, if people in Egypt and in Syria and in Saudi Arabia see today what's happening in Iraq, they're not really into democracy.
That's true.
So George Bush failed here too, miserably.
Okay, so we play some music from the Middle East.
Oh, let's say from Israel. When you say from the Middle East, it sounds very authentic. We are actually, this is a very sort of European type music. Which one are you playing now?
Number 12.
Let's do the other disc, number 12. Okay, we have two discs. Yeah. We can do the number 12 of the first one, as you wish. It's a love song, and it's again by Corinna Lal. It's called You're So Beautiful.
Thank you.
Ja, hier sind wir wieder, die Axiom-Sendung zum Thema Demokratisierung in Osteuropa und im Mittleren Osten. Und Angelika, möchtest eine Frage stellen.
Right now?
Ja. Ich dachte, du möchtest jetzt direkt eine Frage stellen, nämlich zum Konflikt zwischen Israel und Palästina. Palästina hat ja jetzt immer noch ist ein Autonomiegebiet, kein Staat. Und da ist die Frage, wie soll man in einem nichtstaatlichen Territorium von Demokratisierung sprechen, wenn es diese Möglichkeiten gibt? Es gibt ja jetzt das erste Mal hat es Wahlen gegeben und die sind ja so ausgegangen, dass sich alle fragen, warum wählen die diese Partei, also diese
Hamas?
Hamas, ja.
So your question basically is why the Palestinian elected Hamas?
Is that part of a process of democratization that they have election? Would you identify
Here, for example, we have a problem because what happened in the West Bank and Gaza about 2 years ago was actually about a year ago was that the Hamas government was democratically elected. It was fair elections, and Hamas won. But the problem is, what do you do when non-democrats are elected in a democratic election? What do you do? And that's a question I think Germans can appreciate. What do you do when fascists or strongly radicals are elected in non-democratic elections? Do you respect the results? What do you do if somebody is elected who doesn't respect the rights of women? To live like equal life. What do you do if somebody is elected who calls for the state, the neighboring state, that's Israel in our case, to be exterminated? What do you do? What do you do if somebody is elected who wants to kill all homosexuals? What do you do? What do you do if somebody who is utterly non-democratic is elected in democratic elections? Now that's a problem.
I'm just wondering why there is no Palestine, why there is no country there. If I remember correctly, Israel came into being in 1947.
Israel gained its independence in 1948.
48, yeah. Mm. Yeah, but why there is no Palestine as a country? It's a paradox. Just tell me why.
Yeah, well, if we need a short history lesson, and the undisputed facts are that in 1947, as you said, the United Nations decided that in the territory of historical Palestine, that's state, that's bigger Israel, there are going to be two states, the state of Israel, Jewish state, and a state of Palestine, a Palestinian state. And the Jews, who were a minority in the country at the time, accepted this resolution. It's called the partition resolution. The Jews accepted it. The Palestinians did not. And they staged a war against Israel. That's the Israeli Independence War, the War of 1948. And quite unfortunately for the Palestinians, and quite fortunately for us Jews, the Palestinians lost. And with losing, they lost their opportunity to have a nation. However, Israel offered the Palestinians several times ever since the opportunity to have their own independent country. The problem is, the Palestinians want to have a country which is not only inclusive of the Palestinian territories, but is also inclusive of the Israeli territories. That's two countries in one country. That's a bigger Palestine. And until such time when the Palestinians actually accept the idea of having an independent Palestinian state, which is not instead of Israel, but alongside Israel, they would probably not have their own independent state. It's as simple as that, you know. It's a matter of real politics.
But let's have a look at Yasser Arafat. Yeah, he was basically he wanted to have his own country.
Well, it's the question is, without getting into too many details, the question is, what country? And my impression is that what Yasser Arafat wanted is not to have a Palestinian state alongside Israel. That's two states, Israel and Palestine. but he wanted to have a Palestinian state instead of Israel. And this is something that quite naturally Israelis would not agree to, most Israelis, at least. And if you, I mean, I don't think any nation in the world would agree to its to itself being exterminated. It's like Poland giving Poland to Hungary or to Germany. That's unheard of. There is a problem in the Middle East of being not realistic. I think the Palestinians have a dream. I respect this dream. But it's just a dream which is today impossible to fulfill. They should have a state, a small state, the small state that they can have, and try to, you know, develop it, cultivate it as much as possible. But that's it. They can't have any more than that.
And but it started with the dream that Herzl has this idea of Art Neuland.
Oh yeah.
So.
Which is, by the way, German. Let's not have our listeners confused. That's Art Neuland, yeah. Which is, by the way, today.
Yes, that's right. In Berlin, there is now a space which is called Art Neuland. But I missed to visit this. But
you do know there is one major city in Israel today which is called Art Neuland. You do know its name. That's Tel Aviv. Tel Aviv is actually Art Neuland. It means old and new. So Tel Aviv is sort of the manifestation of Herzl's dream.
Yeah. And why is it not possible in having this idea of democracy that the Palestinians and the Israelis have the same dream of living together?
Well, because these are two nations with different dreams, and that's okay to have two nations with different dreams.
Different dreams.
That's okay. I mean, nations have different dreams. Germany and France
have different
dreams.
Palestinian is not a nation.
It is. I mean, they call themselves a nation. Then I respect that. They're not a nation state. There is no state, but they're a nation.
All right, yeah.
I think basically if we need to summarize it, the Palestinians need to reach a decision that they are okay with having a state in the West Bank and Gaza. If they can reach this decision, then the Arab-Israeli conflict can be quite easily resolved. They have not reached this decision yet. Some Israelis have not reached it too, but I think most have. And the Palestinians just have to reach a decision that they settle for 1967 borders, what you see on the map, this green line. They have not. And that's a problem.
Okay. If you want to make any if you want to take part in any policy making, you need some information. You have to be somehow educated to some point. Maybe there is no this kind of information or education in Palestine.
Well, you know, that's a very interesting question. Compared to other Arab societies, the Palestinians are the most, I think, maybe except Iraq, they're the most educated society. It's a very educated society. And because its interaction with Israel, it knows much more about democracy than any other Arab society. Palestinians are very democratized. And I think Palestinians actually know quite a lot about Israelis. I wish we Israelis knew as much about the Palestinians as they know about us. They speak the language. They watch Israeli television. They read Israeli newspapers. It's not a problem of ignorance. This is a real problem that you have several hundred thousand Palestinian refugees living in refugee camps. And nobody ever told them, dear friends, we must forget the dream of going back to Tel Aviv and Haifa, where we used to live. Nobody was courageous enough. Think of post-war Germany, post-war Japan, or South Africa, which is, of course, a different example. What would have happened if they did not have courageous leaders who would tell their people, you must forget about this dream. We can have many other dreams, but this dream you must forget about because it's only going to do us harm. Yasser Arafat was not brave enough to ever come to his people and say, you will not return to Tel Aviv.
But what is with exams like Be'er Sheva, where Israelis and Palestinians are living together? So
which you actually visited, if I remember correctly.
Oh no, I was in Tel Aviv and in Jerusalem and
oh, you haven't
in
visited
Haifa,
Be'er Sheva.
But
okay.
Not Be'er Sheva.
Okay, but
you,
then Tel Aviv
visited?
Okay,
you live there.
You know, I live in the country.
So everything is so close. So.
Yeah, well, it's a few hours, but it's not so far.
Yeah, but why is this not possible to say Israelis and Palestinians, if they want, they can live together
in
Tel Aviv as well?
Well, first of all, Tel Aviv is actually called Tel Aviv Jaffa, and you have several thousand Arabs living in Tel Aviv, Palestinian Israelis. So, of course, it's possible. It's a question of citizenship. And what Israelis do not want is to have a state with a Palestinian majority. Israelis want the Jewish state to be Jewish. Israelis want the language to be Hebrew, I guess, just as Germans want the language in Germany to be German and in Poland to be Polish. Israelis want it to be a Jewish country, just like you would probably like Poland to be a Catholic country. Israelis want it to be Western in its culture and its values, for example, to be a democracy.
Hmm.
So I don't think, because the cultural difference and the social differences and other differences are so evident today, I don't think you can mix those two nations together. What you have in Be'er Sheva and in Tel Aviv is Arab minority, which is, of course, they are citizens, they have all the rights, but they are a minority within a Jewish state. I think what you're suggesting is to have this one big Israeli country where everybody can come and go.
No, maybe a mixture. South Africa is now, the idea from Nelson Mandela was to make a rainbow country, a rainbow culture, where every culture can come together. So, and to justify all the others, other groups which were, because of the history, excluded then after the apartheid, they got the solution in a kind of language system where you have in every country in South Africa you have three or four languages altogether, you have 11 languages, and on the signs and streets you find three languages from the ethnic groups, English and Boerish.
Oh yeah, but
and
I think history tells us that it is best, if possible, it is best for nations to have states.
Justified.
It is best, if you have the possibility. It is best for it is best that Poland is Poland and Hungary is Hungary. You don't want to mix them. You can mix them all in one country, but if you can avoid that, it's best. South Africa is a very exceptional case because you had a very small white minority and a very large black majority. And the minority and majority spoke the same language, and they sort of hold the same religion. They're Christian, they speak English. So it was more a question of racial discrimination. You go there because you're black. What you have in Israel is a very different case. You have two different religions. You have two different languages. You have two distinctly different cultures. These don't go one with the other in one nation state. So the best solution is to have one Jewish state and one Palestinian state. And I know some Palestinians are sort of entertaining, especially in European circles, they're entertaining the idea of having one big state, which is Jewish and Arab. When I look at Arab states today, I'm not sure this state is such a good idea. I'm not sure I would like to live in a state which is like Iraq, Egypt, or Syria.
In a rainbow
nation. I'd prefer. Well, if the rainbow was going to be colored by the colors of Iraq, Syria, and Saudi Arabia, where women are second or third rate citizens and have no rights, then I don't want to live in such a state. Where there is no democracy, I don't want to live in such a state. Where intellectuals are being jailed for expressing their ideas. Where if somebody steals a potato, his hand is chopped off. That's not the kind of rainbow I would like to take part in. Maybe in 200, 300 years from now, we'll have a very different Arab world, very different Muslim world. Then we can all be one big happy family. But that's, I think, not the case. Yes, you need to ask yourself as Europeans today, do you want the state of Israel? to become another Iran? Do you want it to become another Saudi Arabia? Is that what you pick? Is that good for the safety of the world? I mean, is that what you picture as ideal?
I'm just wondering, because basically you are talking about identity. And I think that every country is reluctant to lose its identity. And going back to 2004, 2003, there was debate in Poland and I guess in other countries who joined the European Union in 2004. The question was, shall we join the community and lose our identity? I think the people, I was among them, they were reluctant to join the community because basically I didn't want to lose my identity.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a good point. One of the problems of the European Union is that Germans like to stay Germans and Polish people like to stay Polish. And the European Union is successful up to the point that it doesn't really endanger
the identity
of nations. I just read a survey somewhere that 60% of Germans are against the euro today. Now, that's funny. The euro is a great success story. You have much better economy because of the euro. Why be against the euro? Because the euro symbolizes...
against the constitution.
well, why are people against the euro? Because they want to have their own German currency. Maybe it's not economically or financially, it doesn't make sense. But not everything in life is economical. People want their own identity.
Mm.
Okay.
If you want to play now this... Yom Kippur song?
Well, that's actually the one you're referring to. I think it was first played after the Yom Kippur War, and it resembles the war and everything that's happened. It's called Do You Remember the Songs?
All right, I hope that's...
אתם זוכרים את